The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight's topics are behavioral science for social good and an innovative training program for new teachers. My first guest will be Josh Wright, the executive director of Ideas 42, and he'll explain what behavioral science is all about.
And at the heart of it, it's really about how humans make decisions and take actions, whether they follow through on those decisions. And the reason we've really been focused on that is we feel like that is often missing, not only in social programs, but the design of most products, policies, and social programs, really thinking about how is it that humans truly behave.
And then you will hear from Peter Schulman, the chief executive officer of Urban Teachers. And this is one of the most challenging teacher training programs you are ever going to come across.
I have to say that, you know, many of our folks are in their, you know, mid-20s, early to mid-20s. And looking back, I'm not sure I could have done this program. It is extremely rigorous, and I think that as our individuals go through it, some call it a rite of passage, if you will.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, October 14th. The need for social services provided by the Salvation Army is approaching its lowest level in a decade, after peaking in 2012, according to a new study. Starbucks has announced a $20 million commitment in support of emergency relief for smallholder farmers in Central America affected by sharply lower coffee prices. According to the latest edition of the Forbes 400, only 29 of America's 400 richest individuals have given at least $1 billion and or 20% of their total net worth to philanthropic causes. The magazine is now giving out a philanthropy score to those on the list, ranging from 1 to 5, with 5 being the most generous. The Wharton School received a gift of $50 million. From 1984 Wharton grad Mark Rowan and his wife Carolyn, the largest single contribution in the school's history. Rowan is a co-founder of Apollo Global Management. China's hunger for soybeans is a window into an encroaching environmental crisis, and many suspect that it is the country's fear of running out of water. And finally, All Square, a restaurant in Minneapolis, is designed to give jobs and training to people who are often shut out of employment because of their past. Every employee at this grilled cheese restaurant has a criminal record. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Josh Wright of Ideas 42 right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
Many social programs are designed based on assumptions of how people behave. But what if it turns out those assumptions are wrong? In that case, the program might not do any good at all and could even make a situation worse. At Ideas 42, they look at why people do what they do and the context where these decisions are being made to help improve lives and drive social change. And I'm delighted to have with us the executive director of Ideas 42, Joshua Wright. Good evening, Josh, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Denver, it's great to be here with you.
Give us the founding story of Ideas 42, Josh, including where that name came from.
Sure, absolutely. So Ideas 42 is founded by some academics from Harvard, Princeton, and MIT, and it started as part of a research lab at Harvard about 10 years ago, and then we spun out about 7.5 years ago as a separate 501c3. Now, the 42 comes from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Uh-huh.
The humans have asked Deep Thought, this massive computer, what the meaning of the universe is or the meaning of life, And after much work, Deep Thought comes back and says the answer is 42. The humans get very pissed off and say, you've had all this time to work on it. I can't believe you came up with that answer. And Deep Thought responds back to the humans, well, the problem with you is you don't ask the right questions.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of our taglines, is asking the right questions.
Well, that's a good founding story. Why don't you give us a overview of the field of behavioral science and why you have made that the centerpiece of what you do?
Sure. So behavioral science is basically the combination of behavioral economics, social psychology, cognitive psychology, neuropsychology. And at the heart of it, it's really about how humans make decisions and take actions, whether they follow through on those decisions. And the reason we've really been focused on that is we feel like that is often missing, not only in social programs, but the design of most products, policies, and social programs, really thinking about how is it that humans truly behave, not how we would hope that they would behave,
mm-hmm.
Traditional economists might think they behave, or how we would all hope that we would behave in our best selves.
So when you're designing a system or a program based on behavioral science, are there rules or guidelines that you tend to follow?
Not so much rules or guidelines. It's not a box-checking type of exercise, mm-hmm. but there are some principles. Some of those principles are things like the context in which people operate matter much more than personal attributes of the person, which is surprising to most people. You know, if you ask the typical person, what do you think drives the variability in decision-making by humans, they'll say, oh, it's about 70% individual characteristics, things like their age, race, level of education. And it's actually the opposite. About 70% of it can be explained by the context.
Interesting.
And only 30% by individual characteristics.
Mm-hmm. When these programs are being designed, does that person who's designing them sort of have an archetype of the person that they're being directed to or for?
What we typically find traditionally how things have been designed, they either think about humans as, I don't know if you're a Star Trek fan, but as Spock, right?
Even if you're not, you know who Spock is.
You know who Spock is. This very unemotional individual who can calculate probabilities, can easily weigh all the costs and benefits, and then doesn't have any problem following through on decisions.
Absolutely. Great advice for Captain Kirk all the time.
Or they think about the archetype as Homer Simpson.
Duh.
The human with no self-control. And we have to be overly paternalistic about how we design the program. And the reality is we should think about humans as being quite smart. You know, the 3-pound brain between your ears is a very powerful tool, but it has biases. It can only focus on one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
A whole host of psychological phenomena that exist for humans and their brains, many of which are there for good evolutionary reasons. But it does make it tricky that we're not either Spock or Homer. We're all actually quite bright and intelligent and attractive, but sometimes we make funny decisions.
Well, speaking about decisions, let me ask you about choice. Is it better, the more choices, the better, or is there an optimal number of choices that lead people to take action?
Yeah, the funny thing about choices is that we as humans like choice, so we're drawn to more choice.
Yeah.
But actually, when you have lots of choice, either in the number of choices you have, in the complexity of the choice, or if just the decision between the options is hard, we have a lot of trouble making decisions. And often what that causes us to do is not to make a decision incorrectly. We just delay or procrastinate, which I think everybody knows a lot about procrastination and can feel it and experience it on a regular basis. But it causes us to delay the decision, not to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And we often delay it for a long time to the point where it looks like we're deciding no, when actually we might be happy to make a decision, but there's just too many choices.
You know, there's that old joke, Josh, that if you have 14 frogs sitting on a log over a pond and 9 of them decide to jump in, how many frogs are left on the log? And the answer, of course, is 14. Because deciding to do something and actually doing it are two entirely different things.
Right.
What happens, not with frogs, but with humans, between deciding to do something but then failing to act on that decision?
So it's very specific to the situation, and that has to do with the context.
Mm-hmm.
But humans can decide something, right? And then they have to take the action or many actions, and there might not be, for example, one of the things we often talk about, is there a moment of action? Is there something that cues you to actually remember to take the action? So one of the concepts in psychology is this idea of prospective memory, which is just psychologists' fancy way of saying things you need to remember to do in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has this funny attribute is you have to remember to do it, but you also have to remember to do it at the right time and place, right? And so if you think about something like refinancing your mortgage, something I needed to do when the mortgage rates are really low, when would I think about the need to refinance my mortgage? When I was falling asleep at night every night, right?
Yeah.
It's not a good time to call a mortgage broker,
no.
right? So that's why we have things like reminders and calendars mm-hmm. to help us really remember at the right time. So prospective memory is just one of the things, but there's procrastination also. People put things off.
Yeah.
They may think they want to do something, and then they see what their friends are doing, social norms, and they decide, maybe I don't want to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Small hassles surprisingly get in the way of us doing things that are very, very important.
Yeah, kind of friction. Yeah, yeah, it can really stop you in your tracks and little, say, I'll come back to it later.
Right, little friction, even when the thing is really, really important and big, like filing your financial aid form if you want to go to college, where there's tens of thousands of dollars in grants and loans on the table. Yes, it takes you 4 hours to do that. Any economist would say, like, of course people want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very friction, fraught process, and you can get derailed very easily.
Yeah, I've been there. You're missing that one piece of information, and you'll say, well, I don't know where to get it right now,
right.
and I'll come back to it. And then 6 weeks later, you're back to
and
it.
And the deadline's got passed,
yeah,
and then
right.
you're, yeah. yeah.
You know, so much we have assumed to be true for so long, and we find that to no longer be the case. And the one that's really got me lately is aspirin. And I hear the other day that aspirin is no longer effective against heart disease. I said, geez, you know, I mean, I couldn't believe it when I heard it. So when it comes to social programs, where we have been practicing something for the longest period of time, is there anything along those lines that we now know is just completely ineffective?
I think the biggest thing is that we put a lot of requirements for people to prove that they need the program. And the reason we do that is because we want to make sure that deserving people are getting it. The people who need it the most mm-hmm. are taking advantage of it, and people aren't cheating the system. The research now shows that when you put those hoops to jump through and a lot of those requirements, it's the people who need it the most, the poorest among us, who have the least amount of time, have the most cognitive drain on their mind because they're thinking about managing their life with just too little money, that are not able to take advantage of those programs. So I think that's the biggest one broadly for social programs.
Mm.
We're doing it with a good intention. We want to make sure the right people, the deserving people, get it. But by doing that, we're eliminating the people who are most deserving or preventing them from getting the service they need.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, too, the people who design these programs are doing it a little bit for themselves because they're trying to think, what information would we like to have? And they're trying to collect everything for their data bank and not really thinking of the person on the other end who's trying to navigate these waters.
That's very true. And they're also thinking, I'm thinking about the housing. I'm in the housing department, and I'm thinking about the housing. So I'm just going to ask them for this extra piece of information, forgetting that the person who's thinking about the food program and the person who's thinking about the healthcare program is also has all these questions,
yeah, right?
And so, like, you think about your little world, you're touching one piece of the elephant, you forget that the human, the consumer, at the end of the day, has all these issues they're dealing with, and they're trying to satisfy all the requirements.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a great foundation you just gave us. So let's take a look at a handful of examples to really better understand this. About 18% of students drop out of college in their freshman year, and about a third of them do so because they just can't do the academic work, but there are two-thirds that drop out for something else. You went out to San Francisco State University to see what could be done about this. Tell us about what happened and how you handled that situation.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That first framing, I think, is so helpful because so many people look at the problem of college dropout and think people are dropping out because they're not academically prepared or they don't have the money. Now, that's true for some people,
mm-hmm.
but actually the majority of people, it shows that they're doing okay academically and that there's actually a pretty generous financial aid system. As we talked about earlier, it could be fraught with challenges and hard to get the money sometimes. But it's not those two reasons. There's other things going on. And so what we do is really dig into what could be happening, what's causing this. And we looked at a lot of different factors, interviewed students, looked at data. For example, we thought, well, maybe students who are commuter students drop out at a higher rate. Not true,
mm-hmm.
right? So we eliminate that. But then when we get into it, we realize that whether students think they're college-going material, whether they think they really belong.
Got the right stuff.
Yeah, whether am I qualified to mm-hmm. be here at school? And there's no good feedback loop for them about that. And college is hard, right? For everybody, it's hard. Even if your parents went to college, it's hard often. And maybe if your parents went to college and you're having a tough time, you call home and they say, go get a tutor, work harder.
Yeah.
If you're a first-time student going to college, you call the parents and they say, I don't know, maybe you should come home
mm-hmm.
and I can be more supportive. So students don't realize that everybody is actually struggling at the beginning of college, and that is normal. And so we designed this very low-cost intervention, but is also very interesting. It uses a little bit of jujitsu. So let me describe it to you. We show them a video that's only about 5 minutes long
mm-hmm.
that has vignettes of students who are in their junior, senior year or have graduated, and they talk about how college is hard and what they did to persevere. Now, that's interesting. But then the thing we do is we ask the students what they're going to do when they hit a bump in the road. We ask them what they're interested in outside of school, and we ask them what their goal is in going to college. And then through the course of the semester, we text their own words back to them. So after midterms, when they might maybe got not a good great grade on their midterm and they're struggling, they get the text from themselves saying, here's what you said you were going to do when you hit a bump in the road. That's normal. Now do this. Or we send them a text that says, you said you were interested in graffiti art or rock climbing. The student activity fair is this week on this date. You should go there and meet other people and sign up so you can so they meet friends and have this ongoing social sense of belonging. Now, when you do that, you basically half the dropout rate. So the dropout rate, as you said, is about at San Francisco State University, it's 20% of kids drop out after the first year. That rate goes down to 10%.
Wow.
And we're talking about delivering an intervention that's, you know, under $10 per student. And to get that drop, there's nothing close out there that gets that level of impact for that amount of money.
That is really phenomenal. I know these kids really embrace it, too. They open up the emails. They look at the vignettes. I think 83% of them give you their text number.
Yeah.
So you get them when they're excited, but then you hook them and you keep them there, and it makes a big, big difference.
And we were very – we thought we might get a 70 to 60% response rate.
Yeah.
But – it's, again, the context. When you're a freshman, your first week of school,
Sign up for everything.
You basically do whatever you're told to do.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like a puppy dog.
Exactly, you know what I mean? Exactly.
People often fail to appear for court dates and sometimes for the most minor of infractions, like riding your bicycle on the sidewalk. In New York City, that automatically triggers an arrest warrant, and that can really create a bottleneck in the system, not to mention disrupt a person's life. This is not good. Share with us your work there.
Yeah. Let's first talk about the scope of that problem in New York. We issue in New York 330,000 of these minor infraction. Could be riding your bicycle on the sidewalk, could be littering, could be having an open container in a public place. 330,000 of those a year. 41% of those that we issue result in an arrest warrant, meaning the person doesn't pay the fine or they don't show up for court. That's 130,000 people who get an arrest warrant. Now, what happens when you get stopped for a minor traffic violation or you get stopped again for something else? The police officer at that point has no choice but to bring you in. They can't say, oh, you have an arrest warrant. Let me ask you about it. They have to arrest you and actually bring you down and detain you till you actually have your court hearing. That causes massive havoc on people's lives.
Yeah.
And who do you think that is most affected by that, right? If you or I got a ticket for something like that, the ticket would be relatively small compared to our income. We would pay it. Unfortunately, this is disproportionately impacting people who are lower income.
Right.
So what can we do about that? Now, when you get the ticket looks like a parking ticket. So when we went and talked to people about or showed these tickets to people, people thought it was a minor thing. They had no idea that they could end up with an arrest warrant.
Yeah, big time trouble.
Yeah. So first we redesign the ticket so that it's very clear the implications of what can happen and what you need to do. The second thing was we asked people whether they would give us their cell phone number so we could text them a reminder. Now, when you just redesign the ticket, you get a 13 percentage point drop in not appearing.
Mm-hmm.
When you add the text messaging and the ticket together, it's a 36% drop. So that is a huge, basically for almost no cost, you're reducing in the neighborhood of about 20,000 people a year not getting an arrest warrant, which has massive impact.
Yeah, it can be the simplest things. Let me ask you one more.
Yeah.
Conserving energy in office towers seems like a challenge. I've worked in a lot of office towers, and I can assure you I have never heard this subject brought up just once.
Mm-hmm.
But you went to South Africa to design a pilot around this. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we use some of the same things that we used in the water situation in Costa Rica, which is people don't know how much energy they're using. They don't have any feedback loop for it, right? So we did two things. One, we set up floor-level monitors of how much electricity was being used, right? So there was actual, you could see how much you were using on your floor. And we created a competition between floors. So they could see what they were doing compared to each other again. But the other key thing was we made each floor have a champion, someone who felt responsible ultimately for whether their floor was winning or not.
Oh, yeah, that makes a difference.
And that caused people who are those floor champions to do things like when they're walking out the door, they turn the copier off at the end of the night and tell other colleagues how they're doing compared to their colleagues. And that has a a big 14 percentage point decrease in energy use.
Yeah, it becomes contagious.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about this. Let's say you take something that's been very successful in one setting and try to apply it to another. And I was wondering whether that worked. And a great example of that would be opt-ins and opt-outs. So I think we know that when you opt in to donate organs, participation is very low. When you opt out, participation is very high. We also know that for savings plans. Is it wise or risky to take these kinds of default opt, which have worked in one setting or situation, and then apply them to another?
It's very risky if you don't do what we call diagnosis.
Mm.
Right. So in our process, we actually diagnose the behavioral barriers and what we think is going on with the individual in the context. And if you don't diagnose, you're a little bit like a doctor who, if you walked into the doctor's office and the doctor just looked at you and said, oh, well, let's give him chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Or, hey, let's give him antibiotics.
Probably
right.
Work.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So you can't do that. You actually have to diagnose first. Mm. Because when do defaults work really well? Defaults work well when the desires are relatively homogeneous, meaning that most people have the same desire, and we know what those desires are. If the desires are quite heterogeneous, then you're going to be defaulting people into things that they don't want, and that's very bad. Or you're going to default them into something, and then they're going to have to take the time and effort to opt out of it. A good example of this is the most low-income people get a very significant tax refund because of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a making work pay. They're working, but we want to supplement their income. And most low-income people also say they'd like to save more. So people designed this experiment where at tax time, when they went to the free tax sites, they were automatically defaulted to having 10% of their savings go into a simple savings bond for them. And they did a randomized control test, so half the people were opted in and half the people had to opt out. The funny thing was that there was no difference in the actual adoption rate because people actually opted out of it. They didn't want to do that. And when you go back and ask them and try and figure out what's going on, one of the questions you ask them is like, what was your intention for your tax return when you arrived at the tax site?
Mm-hmm.
Over 75% of people had already committed what they were going to spend that on, either some paying down bills that they had in the past, trying to get some advantage for their kid, or some big purchase they needed to make for
money
their family.
Money was spoken for.
Money was spoken for already. So if you wanted to actually get people to save at tax time, you'd have to actually back up in the process of when they were thinking about the refund and get them to develop the intention that they actually wanted, that they were going to save part of this refund. So that's a good example of just like defaults.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful. You can't just say, oh, this idea of social norms or default worked in one context. Let me use it in another context.
One last question on this. Is there a phenomenon when you change the design of something, let's say a form or an application, and then get a statistically significant change, that change will lose some of its effectiveness over time?
It depends. It can.
Mm-hmm.
So if it were something like simply reducing a hassle, the effect would probably continue on for a very long time. If it were an intervention that was more focused on raising the salience or the likelihood that somebody sees something,
yeah,
that's probably going to fade over time because something like salience, humans are very astute at noticing something that's different or draws their attention quickly, right? But if that thing is always there, then the effect falls away.
You tend to ignore it.
Yeah. So it again, it goes to this diagnosis question.
Mm-hmm.
You have to diagnose the situation and then think through, is it likely or not to fade over time? A good example is the Costa Rica one. We actually said, well, how often would we have to send people these messages? So we did a follow-up study where we looked and said, like, let's send them to them every month. Let's send them to every quarter. Let's send them every 6 months. And basically what we found is that if you send people every 4 to 5 months, then you had the same effect as you send it to them every month,
mm-hmm.
which is actually super powerful because it costs a little bit to put the stickers on and do the adjustment.
Yeah.
So it's very context specific.
Well, Ideas 42, by no means does this work alone. You have a wonderful array of partners, some who you do this work with, some who help finance this work,
yeah.
and in most cases, a combination of both. Who are some of them?
Well, first, I would say a big important partner for us is our academic affiliates.
Mm-hmm.
So Ideas 42 continues to be very connected to its founders, but also about 80 of the leading behavioral scientists around the country. So we can have connections with them. We can call up and ask their advice at any time. And they're very helpful in providing advice. But the other important thing about that connection is that they are doing ongoing research. They're doing the foundational, most cutting-edge research going on. And the funny thing about research is, you know that aspirin study you talked about? It was probably completed about 2 years ago.
Mm.
And the process by which it then actually got into an academic journal and all the evidence was there is very lengthy. We know ahead of time what the latest research is because we're talking to them all the time. So that's the first one. The second one is all of our partners that actually implement and do work with people around the world. Right, Ideas 42 doesn't run programs ourselves.
Yep.
We have to work with partners who are running health clinics, governments and cities that are overseeing programs, businesses like banks that actually offer people savings products. And those partners are critically important to us because at the end of the day, we're working with them. And then lastly, none of this is possible without the generous donations and support from our funders. And that's predominantly foundations, many of the biggest foundations in the world, like the Gates Foundation, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, MacArthur Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also governments that fund us to work directly on their programs. And then sometimes there's businesses that we work with that also fund us.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would guess that the kind of work you do would lend itself to you having a very intentional and thoughtful workplace culture. Tell us what it's like to work at Ideas 42 and how you believe the work that you do is reflected in the corporate culture.
Sure. One of our key core values is what we call the behavioral lens, which means we have to look at everything through a behavioral lens in the world. That's in our personal life and obsessing and learning about behavioral science, but also means that we have to think about how we manage and run the organization within Ideas 42. And it's very prevalent. And I would cite two examples to give you a sense of that. One has to do with vacation. Right. So all the research actually shows that people need vacation,
mm-hmm.
particularly if they're doing creative innovation work like we're doing, to recharge.
Yeah.
Right. Now, some places have tried to do unlimited vacation days, and that actually backfires.
Yeah, nobody takes them.
People don't take them. They look at the norm. They think that no one's taking vacation. Instead, we give a very generous vacation policy. We set it at 24 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's an anchor saying, like, this is what you should be shooting for. But the other thing that we do, we noticed, is that people weren't taking as much vacation as we would have liked them to. And what it turned out was that people wouldn't think far enough in advance about the vacation. So they would say, like, oh, I have these vacation days. I need to use them because I lose them. We take advantage of loss aversion, which is a very powerful behavioral concept for people. But I look and I can't take vacation in the next 2 months because my schedule is filled up. But if I plan my vacation, just not even what I'm going to do, but that I know I'm going to take a vacation 6 months from now, and I put it in the calendar, everything gets scheduled
around
that.
I'll figure something out,
right.
Yeah.
And so that's been very successful. That's one. The second one is an issue that I think many organizations struggle with is feedback, making sure that people give and get feedback. Now, most people give feedback training, and what they focus on is telling managers to give a lot of feedback. The funny thing is, who is it most salient to? Who's most aware that they want and need feedback? It's the person receiving the feedback. So yes, we train the manager to give feedback, but equally we train and encourage people to ask for the feedback because that's critical. It's on their mind. They have the moment of action,
mm-hmm.
as we talked about before. So it's very much within our culture to say, hey, can you give me feedback on this thing? And then the manager wants to give feedback. They don't have the moment of action in their mind. It creates the moment of action, and then feedback's given at a much higher rate.
That's a great point. And I don't think people appreciate sometimes that as important it is to give feedback, the really important person is the person receiving the feedback because they're going to be the ones to either act on it or not act on it.
Yeah.
But we never pay as much attention to that side of the equation. Let me close with this, Josh. You've been at this for a decade now and are starting that next chapter with several new initiatives, including Ideas 42 Ventures. How do you envision the next 10 years being, and in what way will Ideas 42 Ventures be different from the work that you've been doing?
Yeah. So for us, we're going to continue to do a lot of the great work we're doing around discovering what we call discovering these innovations. But the thing we need to get much better at is how do we get these innovations to scale, right? It's not enough just to do it in Belen, Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
We have to figure out how do we get cities in the developing world around the country to adopt something like we did in Belen. And so we have a couple different initiatives about how we're going to get things to scale. And one of them is the Venture Lab. We see an opportunity where things can be done for social good, but also make financial sense to run a business around. So you take the example that we talked about with the community college, the San Francisco State University,
mm-hmm.
where we think there's an opportunity to actually charge colleges a small amount of money for an intervention like that. It funds the intervention. It allows you to create a business and get that business to scale, have marketing people to go and sell it to other colleges. So ventures is really about getting to scale for us. The other things we're doing around getting to scale are we're thinking about creating a policy lab so
That's
that we
great.
Do a better job of translating exactly what we're learning into the policy language for policymakers. And then lastly, we're also thinking about making sure that we do more partnering with people who have scale already built in. That's one of the reasons government has always been attractive to us. That's one of the reasons why New York City and Matt Klein in the Office of Operations is a key partner for us, because New York City is a massive city. It touches millions of people. And that's true of cities around the country. And it's true also when we work within the federal government.
Well, Joshua Wright, the executive director of Ideas 42, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information that visitors will find on it.
Yeah, we welcome people to come to the website. You heard about a few of the projects we've undertaken, but on the website are all the projects we've worked on and details about the projects, how we implemented the projects. Also on the website are major publications we've put together, as well as I want to mention two important links. One is something that we co-founded with some other people, including the Behavioral Science and Policy Association, called The Behavioral Scientist. So this is an online magazine. I encourage people to go onto the Ideas 42 website, find it, and sign up for this separate website, which really makes behavioral science accessible. It's written in a New Yorker kind of style way, very appealing to people, and it's very compelling. The second thing is something called the B-Hub, which is about, it's called Behavioral Evidence Hub, which really unpackages some of these experiments we've done and academics have done, but makes it very accessible to practitioners. So instead of looking at all the statistical charts that academics might be interested in, the practitioner just wants to know, did it work? And then was the actual letter that you designed? Or what was the different script you used or the video that we created? They can actually go and look at and see the real intervention so that they can then replicate it themselves. So very much encourage people to come to the website.
And I'm sure you've made it very easy for them to sign up. Thanks, Josh. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
One of the biggest challenges in the field of education is to find talented and committed individuals to teach in poor and underserved school districts, most of them located in the urban centers of America. An even bigger challenge is to keep them, to not have them burn out and leave the teaching profession altogether after just a couple of years. One organization that believes that it has found an approach to better train teachers, prepare them for the classroom, and lead them to become lifelong educators is Urban Teachers. And it's a pleasure to have with us now their Chief Executive Officer, Peter Schulman. Good evening, Peter, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. Real pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me.
So, Peter, what is the mission of Urban Teachers?
So our mission is to combat racial and socioeconomic inequality by preparing culturally competent career teachers who improve the educational and life outcomes of underserved public school students.
Mm-hmm. And you only became the CEO of Urban Teachers earlier this year, having most recently served as the Deputy Commissioner for the New Jersey Department of Education. What sold you, Peter, on taking this job?
So I think, you know, as someone who got into education first at the district level and went to the state level, all of my training, all of my research, all of my experience has sort of proven out or borne out that, you know, the most important factor in any student's education and in-school factor, that is the quality of the teacher in front of them. It's, to me, something that we're never going to teacher-proof the work that we do, nor should we. We're going to disintermediate the need for great teachers. And as we see the inequities play out in the way that access to money, resources, great teachers, namely in this country, urban and rural students get the short end of the stick.
Yep.
So Urban Teachers was an organization that I had met my predecessor, the CEO, probably 7, 8, 9 years ago when she was getting this off the ground, and really believed in the model and really believed in the idea that this was something that takes hard work. There's no silver bullet. There's no quick fix. And by actually raising the bar around preparation with deeper and
more clinically based preparation to prepare novice teachers was something that was essential for the schools in America.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing similar work at the policy level, so it was great to see an organization like Urban Teachers doing this in practice. And it was sort of a sliding doors moment that as Jennifer Green, the founder and initial CEO, was leaving and I was transitioning out of my government role, there was an opportunity for me to sort of apply for her job.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the profession of teaching in the United States today? How it's perceived by the public? How attractive a career it is for young people, and how even do current teachers themselves view their profession?
So I'll make two overarching statements. One is I believe teaching is the most important profession we have in this country. Two is I'm not going to paint the perception with one brush. I think the world we live in likes to create a narrative which is sort of generalizing from the particular. Having spent time with hundreds, if not thousands, of teachers over the past 13 years, they're vastly different, as any skilled worker in any vocation would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as a country, I don't think we value teaching in the way that we should. I don't think we necessarily compensate teaching in the way that we should. At the same time, I'm not sure we understand the world of a teacher, and I'm not sure the world of K-12 understands necessarily what's going on in other sectors. At times, it's a bubble unto itself. So as we think about this, that I think in terms of that level of valuing teachers, part of it becomes giving them the right level of preparation, coaching, training, support.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that's essential. And I think it's that not only do our teachers deserve it, but our kids deserve
mm-hmm.
it.
Let me generalize, if I may, here and give you a narrative that I think is in a lot of people's minds, and it has to do with teaching in urban schools. What happens is you get a young, idealistic teacher arriving, really wanting to make a difference, but before very long, she burns out, she leaves teaching, and this happens over and over again, and as a result, the schools face instability, and they're the schools that can at least afford it. Why does this happen so often?
So, I'm not going to give you the scientific reason, because I think there's a variety of answers. I'd say let me give a couple hypotheses, and certainly it's a nice lead-in to urban teachers.
Mm-hmm.
First is, the job is really, really hard. Okay? The work is really hard. So I think that before we get into thinking about what the ideas around preparation or compensation or support or mentorship, this is really hard. The way that we've structured urban education or education in this country, it's segregated. It's fragmented, right? We have residential housing segmentation. We have structural racism. We have gerrymandering districts. And more often than not, as we think about the divide within our classes of economic and races across the country, it manifests itself in K-12 education. So it's really hard work. Two is that I don't believe the folks are prepared. So part of the reason that we hear that individuals are leaving, and I did work as the director of recruitment in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and I've worked in places like Wilmington and Camden and Trenton and Newark, is they're not prepared. And oftentimes the training that they've had in their preparation program, whether it be traditional or alternative route, is divorced from the reality of how hard the work is. And when they're put into this typical school district or school or classroom, if you will, it can be an isolating profession. And if they're not supported and they don't have had the training and they don't have the leadership in the building or there's not a system of supports that are set up, a lattice of supports, if you will, to ensure that they're going to be successful, I think it's a real concern. And then the other side of it is, should a first-year teacher be given a full slate, given 5-6 classes with multiple preps? More often than not, because of sometimes seniority rules and sometimes just the culture of the building, novice teachers are put in the most difficult situations. I don't think that's right.
Right. Sometimes it's like starting a rookie quarterback in the NFL in the first game, and he doesn't know nothing. And
I think that's a fair analogy. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Urban Teachers offers the most comprehensive coursework and personalized support of any other teacher training program, at least that I've ever come across. Walk us through it.
Yeah, so I would say that I've come across as well. So I can't make that assertion because I don't know every training program in this country. So our model, which is a joint venture with Johns Hopkins, we're a nonprofit organization. We have a 4-year program. So we have an upfront, very, very rigorous interview selection period where we're trying to identify candidates that not only have the skill set but also have the will set to actually do this work. They bring the growth mindset. They really have an understanding of and passion for making change in urban environments. And our program begins with a full year of clinical residency.
Mm-hmm.
So the first of the full years of the program, you are not a full-time teacher of record. You're in a school building with a host teacher, getting observed, getting coaching, doing coursework at night, which you're then able to apply in a clinical setting the next day, and that coursework is working towards your master's degree.
Mm-hmm. A little bit like a medical residency, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Very much so. And I think that, you know, for us, certainly as you think about what it takes to be, whether it be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant,
mm-hmm.
over time these professions have raised the bar and they feel like more preparation is needed and we really want to be selected because the jobs are so difficult, right? But what it's done is actually it's made those professions more attractive as
yeah.
we see the numbers of folks that are wanting to go into those mm-hmm. You know, levels of both higher ed schooling and then, of course, into the vocation. Years 2 through 4 of our program, that individual becomes the teacher of record in a classroom. They continue to complete their coursework and get their master's degree. They continue to work towards their professional certification in the state that they serve or the city in the state where they work and get support by us. And the idea is that that certification and degree orientation is only going to be granted if they show that they're effective. So they have to keep their grades up. We use some level of quantitative data. We use observation data to actually ensure that that novice teacher is not only prepared in terms of what we would think about from sort of an academic viewpoint, but actually in practice can be a great teacher that can be in front of children.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, children deserve it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about this residency program. So I am a teacher in training, so to speak, that
yes.
first year. I am being mentored, would that be fair to say, by the existing teacher in the classroom?
So you have mentorship with the existing teacher in the classroom, but we also have clinical faculty that works directly with you that we have folks coming in to observe and coach you in real time.
Mm-hmm.
You're then also doing coursework at night with other residents going through the program, and you're working on sort of pedagogical content knowledge. You're giving mock lessons. You're learning some of the methods classes. Content knowledge to the certification area that you're pursuing.
This sounds reasonably rigorous.
Oh, goodness, it is. And, I have to say that, you know, many of our folks are in their, you know, mid-20s, early to mid-20s. And looking back, I'm not sure I could have done this program. It is extremely rigorous. And I think that as our individuals go through it, some call it a rite of passage, if you will.
Mm.
Some during the residency are very critical of it, how hard it is. But when they reflect on it, and I've talked to folks that have been 2, 3, 4 years out of the program, they understand why it was needed.
Sure.
Right? They understand why it was needed, and that level of preparation has put them on a path for success.
Well, our memories are funny that way, too. We always have a fondness around
yeah,
them, but
sure,
surely
sure,
not while
sure.
we're in the middle of it.
Sure, sure.
But
no.
It sounds a little bit like working for one of these big consulting firms, where you start well, out, you're just doing those 70, 80-hour weeks.
It is absolutely hard. I mean, in my first week on the job, I spent some time with what was called our resident advisory group. So these are residents, and it was probably in May. I was about 2 weeks into the job. So May is they're sort of in the 7th or 8th inning of their residency
mm-hmm.
year. And I spent time, I went down to Washington, D.C., and I met with a small group of 7 or 8 of them, and they were just spent. I could tell that they were mentally and physically exhausted. And I said, one funny piece of this is that I said, you know, I'd love to buy you lunch. It was as if they'd never seen food before.
Uh-huh.
They're ordering extra food to go. They're ordering yeah. double. I have at it. But I said, are we treating our residents well enough? But
they sound like people in the media when it comes to food.
Yeah, no. But I'll say this. I don't want to lose that it is so inspiring to speak with them. And the passion they have for this work and the commitment – and the time and the energy that they have devoted to honing their craft
mm-hmm.
and to really focus their moral compass on a subset of our population that is often not in folks, you know, front view.
Right.
It is really unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it also seems very reciprocal because you invest in them a lot. And one of the ways in which you do that is you provide coaching for all 4 years. Tell us about that.
So, you know, this work, again, can be extremely isolating. And I think that, you know, as you think about urban teachers, it's not the idea of urban teachers that can make us successful. It's about how we execute.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, we invest a lot of money in identifying faculty and coaches that are highly skilled educators in concert with Johns Hopkins. They spend a tremendous amount of time observing
mm-hmm.
our folks directly coaching them and saying, I just sat through and watched you teach. I watched your lesson plan on algebraic reasoning. I watched you deliver that lesson. I watched how you differentiate instruction. And we have our own teacher practice rubric across 20 power standards, are our main core of it, that we look for certain context clues. We look to see what's being done in practice. And we're able to actually record this information to meet with someone, to debrief, to call it a post-observation conference, and see how they're improving over time. And as they're getting coursework, as they're working with their peer residents, and as they're working with their coaches, as well as their host teacher, as well as maybe the principal in the building, they're starting to get a confluence of feedback. And in some ways, I always believe more is more, mm-hmm. especially at that sort of nascent stages of becoming a teacher. And we believe, again, we have high-quality folks that are doing the observation, that are giving feedback. It's rigorous. It's consistent. It's actionable. And again, there's no shortcuts. There's no cheap way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason, again, our program is sometimes we call it a Cadillac model. It's an expensive, rigorous, you know, high-touch program. It's what we believe in.
Mm-hmm. How many of your first-year teachers complete all 4 years of the program?
So as we think about our work, we look at the first year of the residency. We have an attrition 15 to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Much of that is folks that we either believe were not ready for the classroom or they themselves have said, this is not for us.
Yeah.
And let me put that in a positive light. From the view of the 9-year-old, the 12-year-old, we want to make sure that when that individual is the teacher record, they're ready for that teacher. They're learner ready day one. So in some ways, as we think about, you know, our attrition metrics, our retention metrics, the idea of the residency year for us is getting folks prepared. Then when we think about how many folks from their first 3 years of teacher training, we're close to 80%, 78% of our folks, which when we look across our urban districts, we're talking that's 15 to 20% percentage points higher than what we see in most areas.
Mm-hmm. And there's a good deal of research that indicates that retention rate does affect learning, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as we think about, from Malcolm Gladwell on downward, teachers improve, especially in the first 5 to 7 years of their teaching career. This is where they actually continue to really accelerate the learning curve. So as we think about, really getting folks past that inflection point within the first 3 years and pushing them towards being career educators, they're honing their craft, they're improving their skill. And again, as I said, it's not divorced from what we see in other professions,
mm-hmm.
right? Anyone who's novice in a certain vocation is going to take some time to become a highly skilled professional. And that's what we believe the same should be true of teachers.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the start of the process, and that is, how do you recruit and who applies?
So great question. So we are, continuing actually to better understand our data and our metrics. So we cast a very wide net.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at this, typically we have a lot of folks that have a little bit of that ideological mentality. And these are folks that are coming from, bachelor's degree programs all over the country. We also have some career changers. We have some mid-career professionals. But in general, we're trying to get individuals that reflect the children we want to serve. So this talks about, in terms of their own diversity, over 50% of our cohort are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, I think over 30%, are first-generation college students. 40% of them had received Pell Grants themselves. And for us, it's not only an ideological element. The research proves this. There's a lot of research from Constance Lindsay and other folks that's saying that as students, especially African-American boys, have teachers that reflect them, it actually translates
right
to dropout rates, fewer mm-hmm. suspensions. I mean, this is real stuff, real data proving this. So for us, it certainly aligns, again, with sort of our moral compass, but it also translates to higher degrees of instructional acumen.
Men don't generally gravitate to the teaching profession. So how have you been doing with men of color?
So I think the number that I read most recently is 2% of our teaching population is African-American men,
mm-hmm.
right? 2%. Which is, certainly not indicative when you're working in a Baltimore, a Dallas, a mm-hmm. D.C., where you can have classrooms that are 70 or 80% African-American children. So first and foremost is the road is steep. Certainly where I came from most recently in New Jersey, 77% of our teachers were Caucasian women.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where, you know, we spend a lot of time recruiting. And this is everything from going to recruitment fairs on campuses, doing search engine optimization, if you will, and Google AdWords and all that fun stuff. We do work with folks like Teach for America and City Year, folks that are similarly, you know, looking at these type of candidates because we think there's synergies and folks that may not be ideal for their program but might want to be interested in our program. We think there's some, again, economies of scale there, scope rather. And it's really, for us, you know, continuing to really cast a wide net to get people who are interested. And then the next phase of it is really having a tight funnel. Mm-hmm. To actually figure out sort of who the sort of contenders from the pretenders are.
Gotcha.
And I think in this day and age, a lot of individuals will say, that sounds interesting. They'll float a resume in. They'll start an application. But as they understand, do you really want to be a teacher? Do you really care mm-hmm. about urban children? Are you devoted to this? Do you want to be a lifetime educator, right? What is your growth mindset? Because if you don't have a degree of resiliency yourself, you know, where we were going before is we're going to see a lot of attrition.
Sure.
So we got to make sure we find the right people. And I'll say that we haven't cracked this nut. Mm. You know, trying to better understand this and trying to understand what the right elements or attributes are of that perfect candidate, it's going to be accretive over time as we continue to learn.
It's always going to be a work in progress.
Yes.
You'll never get there. You'll always be making it better and better and better.
Well, I'm hoping yes. That's right.
You know, those cities you just mentioned a moment ago, are those the ones you operate in?
Yeah. So right now we're in three cities. Again, we're in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Dallas. 9 years ago, we started in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore. Baltimore mm-hmm. probably being our flagship with our partnership with Hopkins. And then about 3 years ago, we added the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Peter, how do you view or measure the impact that you're having?
It's a great question, one that's also that we're evolving. So I think that I look at this as that, you know, the reason that I'm personally in this work, and I think that all of my colleagues and most all of the teachers, is that we want to impact the lives of children. Right? Children are the unit of measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at them, we want to be able to track them longitudinally. And the idea is for them to have, you know, productive lives, right? And sort of what are the metrics that are the sort of leading and lagging indicators within that? So first is that for us is there's growing relational databases and state longitudinal data systems that are starting to allow us to track this. Certainly test scores and graduation rates and starting to understand, you know, are folks going through to and through college and eventually getting to gainful employment. I think probably 10, 15 years ago when I started in education, this data was not within reach. I think it is now.
Yeah.
I think it's for us, it's certainly an opportunity to actually better understand, you know, where our folks are going, but also trying to figure out what is the causal, not just correlation, but what is the causal relationship between our teachers and these results. And for us, what are the set of conditions for success? Is it clustering a number of urban teachers?
Mm-hmm.
Is it finding the right principal? Is it finding the right school? Is it finding the right district that
has
the
levers?
Right curriculum? What are these levers? Because I don't believe our program unto itself can be a single lever. We got to be part of a cohesive solution. And on the teacher side, there's a number of indicators. We talked about retention,
mm-hmm.
right? We talked about observation scores. We are going to see folks' GPA. There's a number of metrics that we're using. These, we believe, are proxies for quality. Again, I don't think anyone individually is a perfect proxy, but the compound or the confluence of these elements together give us a hypothesis that we can test against to say, are these teachers effective? And then what are the conditions that we're going to do to support them to actually sort of elevate, you know, their effectiveness
yep.
and then track it over time?
What's your business model? How much of it's earned income? How much philanthropic dollars? And who've been some of your key supporters and partners?
Great question. So we have a budget of close to $24 million. We are about 60% earned revenue and about 40%, $9 million or so in philanthropy. This number, just to be clear, is something that we continue to reduce over time as a percentage of our overall budget.
Right.
It's important for us as we think about being a fiscally healthy organization, as we think about sustainability, and the practical nature of wanting to actually do something that can actually sort of over time impact the K-12 ecosystem. In terms of our funders, we're really fortunate, and again, I can't take any credit for this. We have a combination of national funders like the Schusterman Foundation and the Overdeck Foundation and the Walton Foundation,
mm-hmm.
folks that have really been invested in K-12. And for many of them, the sort of what they call it, the human capital element is one element within their portfolio as they think about other change agents within schools. And then at the local level, and I think this is equally if not more important, we have local foundations and these you know, in Baltimore, when you think about the Abel Foundation or the Blaustein Foundation, these are folks that are very invested in the city. And they've put millions of dollars to try and improve the quality of outcomes in that city. So we're a part of that portfolio. And what's really exciting to me about that is, as I think about the work and what I talk to our team about, we want to go deep, not wide. The goal is not for us to be in 75 cities mm-hmm. across the country. The goal is for us to really go deep in Baltimore, to really think about this as a part of a generational solution to what are generational problems. And to us being, again, part of a broader emphasis to say, is there a community movement? Is there a broader K-12 push to say, how are we going to work on this together? And for us, that's where we want to plug in. That's where we want to do work. And it's probably not as sexy or appealing to say. It's like, this work takes time. It's going to be hard. We want to be there for the long run.
Yeah.
We don't think there's any quick fix solution to this.
Yeah, well, I admire your discipline, because there is such a temptation on the part of boards of organizations in particular to be in more cities all the time. And you have a model here that you're still proving out. So before you take it over the country, let's get it really, really right. And that does take time. Tell us about your corporate culture at Urban Teachers, and maybe give me a thing that you and your team do that in the workplace that you think is particularly cool.
So it's interesting. As the so I'm still a newish CEO.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, what's unique for me in this role is that I'm entering an organization where there's some level of it being incumbent for me to fit into the culture. I need to mesh. There had been a culture there. So I'd say what's both interesting and challenging. So we're an organization, as you know, clearly mission driven, that talks about diversity, equity, inclusion. So we've talked a little bit about that today in terms of what our recruitment mm-hmm. process looked like, what the composition of our cohort. But these are values that we want to live both personally and professionally. And we wrestle with this. And certainly as a white CEO, I wrestle with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is unique about, you know, where the organization has been, and I think something that we're continuing to evolve in, is that we're going to put the tough conversations on the table. I come, you know, from, I would say, for the last 13 years, I've been at district and state government, where it probably would be breaking some regulation for us to have some of these conversations because they're hard to have.
Yeah.
And for us, these manifest themselves in not only the spirit by which we do the work, but actually operational decisions. And I can sort of talk about it, you know, as we think about our admittance processes, and we see that in our desire to recruit and bring African-American male candidates into our cohort, we see we had some barriers.
Mm.
We had put up some gates. And as we think about that, how do we remove those barriers? How do we provide additional supports? How do we think about equity, right? Not just equality, but equity, meeting folks where they are and supporting them to actually get over those hurdles to make sure that they are ready to be in our cohort. So I think, you know, what's really impressive about Urban Teachers is not that we have a perfect inclusive culture, but we have the will to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have an outspoken nature where anyone in the organization, and they've done this, and say, Pete, you're the CEO, you're wrong in this case, or you need to think about this, or there's a teachable moment for you, and making sure there's not just a hierarchy of, I can't say this to that person because, you know, it's on the step scale of the ladder,
sure.
I can't do that.
Feedback can go from any person to any other person in the organization.
Yeah. And we've been, you know, there's a lot of folks that have been reading the book Radical Candor and being saying that you gotta be able to say that. And even if someone is a colleague, a friend, you have to be able to let someone know that, you know, what you said or did or how you acted or how you're thinking about this, you know, needs to be, you know, rethought. Or maybe you didn't consider X. And I'm someone who believes, especially, again, I'll reiterate this, as, you know, as a white male, I have blind spots,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not just, you know, me having the best of intent. That's not good enough, right? It actually has to play out not just in my thinking but my actions.
Sure, sure. Sometimes if you haven't lived the problem, it's harder to address the problem.
Absolutely.
And knowing that is one of the best things you can possibly do.
Right.
Because it keeps you learning and it keeps you open.
That's exactly where I was going to go. I think that one of the things that we push our children, we want to talk about this term lifelong learners. Well, we as adults should be the same.
Yeah.
And I think that's, for me, that's got to be part of our culture in Urban Teachers. And I think, again, I'm fortunate to be stepping into an organization that has sort of laid the blueprint for this over the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me close with this, Peter. You're the new CEO, so I would imagine your vision is still being formulated. But where do you see the organization being 5 years from now? Where would you like it to be?
So I would like us to probably close to
So I think we're bringing about 300 residents a year now.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly want to move us to a conversation more about impact than simply resident quantity numbers, but I do see us potentially adding maybe one more city, moving the number from 300 to 500 or so residents.
Mm-hmm.
Reducing our reliance on philanthropy from probably 40% to 20%, and really make a concerted effort to study our impact, really invest in R&D, really invest in data, and really invest in sort of what I would consider is real continuous improvement. I would also say the lofty or the aspirational vision here is to really accelerate the dialogue in this country around teacher preparation. We are, in from a magnitude standpoint, we're a drop in the bucket. When we think about the hundreds of thousands of teachers who entered the profession. So how can we be a proof of concept? How can we start to change the narrative? How can we actually show that more deeper, rigorous clinical preparation is essential for the profession and start to change policies, start to change regulations, start to work with, higher ed in this country and through a different lens? Because I think this is something that's genuinely possible, and that excites me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Shulman, the Chief Executive Officer of Urban Teachers, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us what's on your website and how people can apply for the program if they might be interested.
Oh, fabulous. I get to do a plug. It's urbanteachers.org. You can go there. You can apply directly on the website. Our application is open. You can learn about our program. You can see anecdotes from our residents. You can learn about the cities we serve. And you can have access to all of our staff and alumni to really understand what we're about.
Thanks, Peter. It was a pleasure to have you here.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Rebecca Rimel, the longtime leader of one of the most significant and multifaceted nonprofit organizations in the country, the Pew Charitable Trust, which also includes a Pew Research poll that we're all familiar with. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.